This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Bob Edwards. As the U.S. Supreme Court justices leave Washington for teaching duties and summer vacations, they leave behind a stunningly altered legal landscape. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports on the newly concluded Supreme Court term.
The nation's highest court is normally a staid institution in which emotions are not displayed. But last week saw the justices both intense and angry as they announced decisions and dissents from the bench to spectators who received those decisions with tears of joy and sometimes fury. It was a week in which the body politic postured in anticipation of retirements that never occurred, leaving the nine justices, with an average age of 70, to be the longest-serving group of justices since the early 1800s. It was a week in which the court resolved some of the most controversial legal issues of our times, affirmative action in college and university admissions, and the rights of homosexuals to private intimate relations free from state harassment. Many court observers had predicted that the court would rule narrowly on these questions, but instead, the justices acted boldly, declaring unequivocally that diversity in education is a compelling national interest that trumps, at least for now, the notion of colorblindness, and declaring that it had been wrong in 1986 in upholding state anti-sodomy laws. Berkeley Law Professor John Yu.
In part, the court wanted to settle some of these issues, change the law so that its results paralleled conventional public opinion about affirmative action and about gays in society.
That view is echoed in the words of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the author of the court's affirmative action ruling. In a book of essays she published this spring, she wrote, quote, "Rare is the legal victory that is not the careful byproduct of an emerging social consensus." And that appears to be what happened this term. Stanford Law Professor Pam Carlin.
The things that mainstream, well-educated, moderately conservative Republicans feel comfortable with, this court feels comfortable with, too.
In the affirmative action cases, the court was candid in saying it had been influenced by the views expressed in briefs filed by military, business, and education leaders. In the gay rights case, the court was likewise candid in declaring that public acceptance of homosexuality had changed, as evidenced by the fact that only 13 states still made homosexual conduct a crime. University of Virginia law professor John Harrison.
When a lot of the country and most of the elites have come to a position, the court often will then act against regional outliers. The point being that in some sense, the court, when it does that, is kind of a majoritarian institution, acting on behalf of national majorities against local majorities or state-level majorities.
In many ways, the ghost of the late Justice Lewis Powell seemed to haunt this court term. In 1978, Powell was the fifth vote in the first affirmative action ruling, the celebrated Bakke case. His view, expressed in a solo decision 25 years ago, was embraced by a majority of the court last week. 8 years after Bakke, Powell again cast the deciding vote, this time to uphold state anti-sodomy laws. It was a vote he vacillated over inside the court and later said he regretted. Powell's biographer, University of Virginia Law School Dean John Jeffries, says the justice came to the education question with a sure-footedness that he lacked on the gay rights issue.
He had been on the school board in Richmond, Virginia, and he had been on the State Board of Education, and he had been on the governing boards of a public university and a private university. He knew a lot about higher education, and he felt some confidence in his views in that area. The area of homosexual relations was new to him and unfamiliar, and I think he never came to rest in his own mind with the clarity and confidence that he did in the area of affirmative action.
Stanford's Pam Carlin clerked on the court in 1986, the year of the first sodomy case, and remembers the discomfort of many of the justices.
Probably the most famous example of this was Justice Powell, who remarked to a clerk who was gay that he didn't think he'd ever met a gay person. I think this time around all the justices not only knew gay people, but knew that they were gay.
Indeed, many of those people, some of them former law clerks for the justices, were in the courtroom last week, and when the gay rights decision was announced by Justice Kennedy, some smiled broadly, others wept. In an angry dissent from the bench, Justice Antonin Scalia accused the six-justice court majority of taking sides in the culture war, and few could deny that, at least to some extent, he was right. The court saw its role as protecting individual rights in this case, against what it said was, in effect, majoritarian oppression. In reaching its conclusion, the court for the first time cited the courts of other nations. Stanford Law School Dean Kathleen Sullivan.
It was a major historical moment for the United States Supreme Court in a majority opinion to cite the European Court of Human Rights as a helpful precedent that shows Western social consensus on the legality of gay sexual relations. That was dramatic. It hasn't happened before. It's a trend that other justices, such as Justice Scalia, decry. He says, why should we pay any attention to what the Europeans think?
Affirmative action and gay rights were not the only important issues dealt with by the court this term. For most of the last decade, the court has treated many congressional judgments without much traditional deference and has deferred instead to states' rights. In recent years, for example, the court has ruled that state employees have no right to sue for damages when they are the victims of discrimination based on age or disability. And the justices also invalidated a key provision of the Federal Violence Against Women Act. This term, however, the court broke with that line of states' rights decisions and upheld a federal law mandating family and medical leave for state workers. The decision, written by the court's chief proponent of states' rights, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, astonished most court observers. Professor Yu.
The court struck down the Violence Against Women Act and said that it didn't rise to that level. So somehow here the court has said the Family Medical Leave Act is more important a federal interest piece of legislation for civil rights than the Violence Against Women Act? That doesn't make any sense.
Although headlines shouted that this term was one of civil liberties victories, there were important civil liberties defeats, too. The court upheld the detention without bond of legal immigrants who were fighting their deportation. It upheld the California Three Strikes Law, in this case upholding a 50-year prison term for a petty thief whose third offense was shoplifting. And the court also, for the first time, imposed strict limits on punitive damages. Stanford's Kathleen Sullivan.
What's dramatic this term is that it said it isn't unconstitutional to have very long sentences for very small crimes, but it is unconstitutional to have very big punitive damages awards for very small harms in the tort system.
Interestingly, in the punitive damages case, the dissenters included the court's two most conservative members, Justices Scalia and Thomas, while the court's more moderate conservatives sided with business interests. It was a pattern replicated in a handful of other cases of interest to American business, notes Duke Law Professor Walter Dellinger.
These half-dozen cases reflected a very fundamental split. In every single instance, the side favored by business was supported by Justices O'Connor and Kennedy. In every single instance, the side that was a nightmare for corporate America was adopted by Justices Scalia and Thomas. It's a very dramatic split.
Scalia and Thomas are the two justices President Bush has cited as his role models for a Supreme Court justice. The president, of course, didn't get a vacancy to fill this term. The justices, all but two of whom were appointed by Republican presidents, decided to stay put for now. Harvard Law Professor Charles Fried.
They must have thought the Democrats are making a terrible fuss, impossible to deal with, and the Senate can only be better 2 years from now.
For President Bush, the court term may have been a great relief. Both affirmative action and gay rights are off the political table for the coming election, and there is no looming confirmation fight over a Supreme Court nominee. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.